Welcome to the Hunting Science Podcast. My name is Mark Lindberg and I will be your host. Along with my guests, we will explore how science informs hunting by asking why questions. In addition, we will explore how science is used in management. Our focus will be somewhat on Alaska-specific topics, but we are open to other ideas and encourage you to suggest those ideas through our website. Welcome back to the Hunting Science Podcast. This episode of it is Jim Sedinger talking about the history of discovery and ultimately waterfowl research on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta of Alaska. This podcast came about when I overlapped with Jim during my June 2019 visit to the Tatakuk River study site where Jim had worked since 1984. Well, I guess he wasn't at that site. He was on the Yukon Delta since 1984. And Brant research has been going on at the Tatakuk River site since that time. If you remember in a previous podcast, we also recorded Dave Coons and Jim Sedinger talking about harvest management. And this podcast came about because Jim, during that visit, was still recovering from knee replacement surgery and was willing to stay behind while we were out collecting some data and basically self-interview. So I'm just introducing his podcast about the history of discovery and research at this site. I asked Jim to recount this because he has incredible memory and knowledge of this area and focus in the latter part as he did on how this research and science that was done in this region has affected management, particularly in the last 3-4 decades. So what follows is Jim's self-interview, basically recounting this history. And just a little background again, Jim is recently retired faculty member from University of Nevada, Reno. Prior to that, he was at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where I worked under him as a PhD student in 1990 through 93 at the Tatakuk River site. Jim again led that camp effort up through 2018, and then I started returning to the site in 2016 and took leadership of the site in 2018 and continue to do so this year. And it's been a real privilege to return and continue that work. So I hope you enjoy this history. It's pretty impressive. His memory of it, he's drawn on this without any notes, just his experiences. And you can see that we have it pretty good now, considering what they started with when this work began in 1984. We're now using communication that allows us to text daily in real time. And back then they were much more limited communication and much more risky situation, but they still pulled off the work and it was pretty impressive. So I hope you enjoy.
Let's talk a little about the history of waterfowl research on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, which is now a national wildlife refuge. The first scientific work that I'm aware of that was done on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, which stretches from beyond the mouth of the Yukon River on the north to the mouth of the Kuskokwim River on the south, about 250 miles or so of deltaic coastline, which supports some of the most abundant and diverse populations of water birds at high latitudes in the world. The first person to do scientific work out here was Edward Nelson, who worked for the Army Signal Corps in the 1880s, and he traveled extensively around the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, primarily during the winter time when he could travel by dog team, but he also made records of natural history. And he reported Brant on the Yukon Delta at that time, particularly migrations past or the mouth of the Yukon River. The next expedition or the next intensive work to be done out here on the coast of, was the Brandt, it's B-R-A-N-D-T, expedition to Hooper Bay in 1924. The Brandt expedition mushed dogs from Ninan or Fairbanks, I don't recall exactly which, out to Hooper Bay. It took about a month. Brandt himself was an oologist, a person who studies bird eggs, from the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. He was accompanied by Frank Dufresne, Olus Murray, and Conover. I don't recall Conover's first name. And I think that Murray, and who had been in Alaska for a number of years at that point as a biologist for what's now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Dufresne's job was to keep, make sure Brandt and Conover were safe in their travels. But at any rate, it took a month for them to get from interior Alaska out to Hooper Bay. They arrived at Hooper Bay in April, and they stayed in the school there. And they made observations of around the Hooper Bay region of both migration and nesting. They recorded large numbers of brant moving past Hooper Bay and stopping in Hooper Bay during their observations there. They also traveled the drag kayaks across the land north of the village of Hooper Bay to what we now call Kokichik Bay. It was called Igiak Bay in those days. And kayaked then across Igiak Bay to camp at the base of the Askanuk Mountains, and they recorded some of the more upland nesting birds on that trip. They also had terrible weather. And then they visited the flats at the extreme west end of Igiak Bay on their return trip, where they reported a number of Steller's eider's nests, as well as other waterfowl that are common out here. They did not report Brandt on this trip, and that's been interpreted as indicating that Brandt weren't present. But it's quite possible that they were well west of where Brandt had traditionally nested and just missed them. The next work that I'm aware of out here was two visits by Charles Gillam to the Chivac area in 1941 and 1942. And it's interesting, I came out on this trip. I'm sitting in a weatherport in my long-term study site, which is now managed and run by Mark Lindbergh. I left home one morning, overnight in Anchorage, and I was in camp the next late afternoon. Charles Gillam took a month to get from his home in Illinois to Alaska and out to this study area. And the fact that Gillam was assigned, he was a Fish and Wildlife Service employee, to visit the coastal zone of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta in the 1940s is an indication that people were well aware of the large concentrations of waterfowl. In those years, people were most interested in ducks and geese, which were being harvested by hunters. Gillam arrived in late June on his first trip in 1941, and reported large numbers of brant near the mouth of the Kishunik, where the present-day colony is. in large brood flocks. So brant were abundant in this region in 1941. He didn't make the same efforts to get down to the lower Kishunik River in 1942. I just mentioned also, I forgot to mention when talking about the Brandt expedition, that Olus Murray and Dufresne took an old slow steamboat from Hooper Bay around up the coast a few miles and into Kokichik Bay, and then up the Kokichik River from which they could connect to the Kashunik River and travel down to the mouth of the Kashunik by an inland route without having to go spend much time in the open Bering Sea. They visited Kashunik Village, which is about 6 or 7 miles north of the current location of the Tutakok River Brant Colony. In July of that year, and we're told by the local Chupik residents of Kashunik Village of large numbers of brant near the mouth of the Kashunik River, but they did not believe the accounts, and they didn't come downriver to check on whether birds were present. So the first real records we have of this colony date back at least to 1924, and if there were large numbers of brant present at that time, it's an indication that they had been nesting here for some time prior to that. Following Gillam's visits here in 1941 and 1942, the next intensive activities began around 1948 and 49 after the Second World War, when the Fish and Wildlife Service began surveying the coast to try to determine where concentrations of birds were nesting. And those efforts really continued through the 1950s before they established where concentrations of cackling geese and brant and emperor geese were nesting on the coast here. In addition, by 1949, there were crews coming down the Kashunik River and camping in the lower Kashunik River area to begin banding brant. And those banding activities, again, date back to the late 1940s. Sigurd Olsen maintained the first kind of extensive study site in this area in 1950. He developed a study site that encompassed some upland habitats about 8 miles north of the Tutakok colony, another intensive study site in the Hawk Slough area, which is about 5 miles as the crow flies north of us, and then a third site that was part of what we are now studying is part of the Tutakok River Brant colony. And Olsen reported significant numbers of brant here, as well as along the lower Kashunik River. He also reported a small number of Steller's eider nests in his Hawk Slough study area, so indicating that there were Steller's eiders again on the coast of the Yukon Delta, although it's unknown how abundant they were at that time. Additional ground studies were done here in the early 1960s by Pete Shepard, recording nest success, clutch size, etc., of both brant, a brant cackling geese, and a number of other species of waterfowl. The parts of the refuge had been identified prior to the early 1960s, but by 1962, the central coast of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta had been set aside as National Wildlife Refuge. And a resident manager was in place by 1962. That was Jim King, who is famous for initiating much of the aerial survey activity over the state of Alaska, or at least not initiating, but continuing and expanding. And then he was followed as manager. Jim moved on to actually take on regular aerial survey responsibilities for the Fish and Wildlife Service. He left the refuge about 1965. And was replaced by Cal Lensick, who spent at least a decade on the coast or in Bethel managing what was then known as Clarence Road National Wildlife Range. And a bit more on Cal in a minute. Jim King, while he was in a publication after he was manager, but described during his tenure as manager, as many as 150,000 brant being present in late summer in the coastal zone of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. So there are substantial numbers of brant here, and those would have included non-breeders, fail breeders, as well as young of the year and breeding adults. during Cal's time here, and Cal was also a legend in wildlife biology when I arrived in Alaska in the early 1980s, and I had the pleasure of working with Cal for a year at the Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage. But Cal had come to Alaska in 1950 or 51 to be a student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks when there were just a few hundred students there. He got a master's degree there studying marten, and then initiated or began a number of studies, including very well-known studies of Yukon Flats. At the time, there were proposals to dam the Yukon River and flood the Yukon Flats. And Cal's work, along with work done by Jim King, demonstrated the tremendous importance of Yukon Flats to nesting ducks. Cal also had a number of other assignments, working on seals, predators. He then went on to do a PhD before he assumed the refuge manager job in Bethel on sea otters through Purdue University. And so Cal actually spent a fair amount of time in the Aleutian Islands early on in his career as well. But he came to Bethel around 1965, and at that time he had an assistant manager, a secretary, and then Cal made it a practice to hire a number of local Yupik residents of the villages to work for the refuge on both activities in the field as well as doing maintenance on refuge equipment in Bethel. And Cal also made it a practice of welcoming those folks, as well as anyone else who was visiting Anchorage, to stay with him at his home. He was a lifelong bachelor, and his home was like a museum of the lifestyle of the folks that had lived in the coastal zone of the Yukon Delta. But Cal, because there were no biologists on the refuge at the time, and he was a trained biologist and interested in trying to improve the understanding of the resources on the refuge, took it upon himself to begin collecting data as best he could while he was managing the refuge from Bethel during the week. So Cal took it upon himself to fly out to the coastal zone where the birds were from Bethel on Friday afternoons and conduct biological studies on Saturday and Sunday before returning to Bethel. He surveyed swans on his route from Bethel out to the coast. He established long-term brant nesting plots that were still being done through 1980. And I helped participate in those in my very first year on the Yukon Delta in 1977. That provided a long-term record of, or at least a 15-year record of nesting brant in the lower Kishinik River area. Cal banded thousands of brant during his tenure as refuge manager. And he was the first to find that neck collars were detrimental to brant geese, and wrote a small paper about that in the late 1960s. Cal also encouraged a lot of research by graduate students. So the refuge didn't have a lot of money in those days, but the resources the refuge had available to them were put to use in supporting students in whatever way they could. So there were no stipend support, no salary support for students, but there were boats and motors and fuel, and food was made available for field work. And two wildlife monographs, one on emperor geese at Kokchuk Bay and one on the community of geese nesting near Old Chivac, about 10 miles inland from where I'm recording this, by Pete Mickelson, who was from the University of Michigan. And I actually used a cabin that Pete had built on that study site to conduct my PhD work here in the late 1970s. Amongst the others that Cal Lensig supported was an undergraduate at the University of Lethbridge, John Eisenhower, who actually began work on brant geese at the Tutakok River Colony in, I think, 1974. And John spent three field seasons here, It might have been 1973, 74, and 76, something like that. Made a number of really important natural history observations about Brandt in this area. Another person that's became indirectly important to me was Margaret Peterson. Margaret worked for David Eisenhower on the Emperor Goose work at Kokchuk Bay that formed part of David Eisenhower's PhD dissertation. And that then led to her being supported by the refuge to study Pacific and red-throated loons, which Margaret did as a master's degree research for a master's degree at the University of California, Davis. Her advisor there was Dennis Raveling, who was very well-known waterfowl ecologist in North America and actually eventually worldwide. And Dennis, or Rav as we called him, visited Margaret during her master's work, helped her collect some of her data, and then returned in 1974 to begin work on nutrient dynamics of cackling geese during the breeding season. So he came out in the spring to collect geese to begin to try to understand how the fat and energy and protein that females stored before nesting were being used by those females to produce their eggs and to incubate the clutches. Rav returned in 1977 to continue that work. And in the meantime, I had become a graduate student at the University of California, Davis, and was looking for an advisor. And I took Rav's upland game birds and waterfowl course. I did well in the course, and I guess well enough that he thought I was okay. And then I approached him with an idea for a project to be done on foraging ecology of geese that just happened to strike his fancy. So we initiated a set of discussions where he would give me an obscure dissertation to read. I would go off to the library. In those days, we were reading these things on either microfilm or microfiche. I would come back a week later and we'd talk about it. And that December of 1976, he accepted me into his program as a graduate student. And that next May, Rav and Craig Ely and I flew to Bethel, Alaska, with the idea of starting or to begin the work that we would do on geese in Western Alaska. At the time, the refuge still had a pretty small staff, but there was a biologist, Chris Dow, and he and his wife, Carla, generously had us for dinner and drinks in the evening. Then we rolled out our sleeping bags, literally in the floor of the refuge manager's office, where we slept for a couple of evenings. And the second evening we were with the Dows, we were waiting for weather that was adequate to fly us out to the coast. We had had dinner and we were talking biology, and Chris got a call from the air charter service saying that conditions were good to go. This was about 10 o'clock at night. So around midnight, we loaded up the plane, flew out to Old Chivac, which is an old Catholic mission site, now a Fish and Wildlife Service research building. We landed about midnight at Old Chivac. We got into the building. The entrance was buried in snow that had drifted in. Jack Paniak, who was a resident of Chivac, had come out ahead of time, shoveled out the entrance, so we were able to get into the building. Got into the building, got the heat going, and proceeded to stay up all night drinking whiskey and playing cards and talking. Chris and Jack showed up the next morning about 8 o'clock. We, of course, had only been asleep about 3 hours with the snow machine, and they were ready to help us haul gear down to what would be the campsite about 4 miles south of Old Chivac. So off we went with a fair amount of food provisions and covers for a canvas wall tent, etc. Dropped all that off. On the way back to Old Chivac, the snow machine ran into some overflow that was covered by thin ice, broke through the ice, killed the engine. And we were fortunately very close to Old Chivac. We had to, well, we had to walk back to Old Chivac, but Jack Paniak spent a couple of hours trying to get the snow machine started with no success that evening. Craig and I were out with him for that time, not being much help, but it was, we were pretty excited about our first experience in Alaska. And the next morning we got up at 8 o'clock. Jack had gotten up ahead of us, gotten the snow machine going, and was already home in Chivac. I should just mention in passing that Jack is a guy that I wouldn't say we ever, I got to know Jack well, but we became friends. He was at the refuge during my whole dissertation period. And Jack was relatively, I don't know about famous, if that's the right word, but he, as an 18-year-old, had guided Roger Torrey Peterson and Peterson's friend when they visited the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta for the chapter on Tundra of the Emperors that's in the book Wild America. So Jack had been working in with biologists for quite some time, and he was involved with working with Cal Lensick on banding geese in the summers. He was responsible for maintaining the buildings at Old Chivac, and quite a guy. So the first season that I spent in Alaska, I helped Rav with his studies of cackling goose nesting ecology. Craig did as well, just the three of us in camp. And that year, Craig and I stayed at Old Chivac for another couple of weeks after we'd hauled our gear downstream. Rav had been caught on the wrong side of the river during a breakup in 1974 when he was out on the Yukon Delta. So he was nervous and wanted to get down there early. So he preceded us down to camp about a week earlier than we did. We hiked down with our gear, personal gear, a bit later, and we're ensconced in camp, and then we started searching for goose nests and recording data. And it was Rav and Craig slept in the tent frame, and I had my own little tent outside where I spent the nights. And our basic schedule was we get up and have breakfast and head out sometime around late morning between 10 and 11. We'd be back at camp between 9 and 10 in the evening. We'd have dinner and maybe play cards a bit, go to bed. That particular year, we had enough provisions to get us until about through the first week of June, but it turned out that it was one of the latest breakups that people had observed on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, so the river ice didn't go out until around June 7th or 8th, and then it was these large chunks of ice flowing back and forth until about June 13th. So it was really June 13th before we could get back to Old Chivac to replenish at least basic food supplies. And our last few days in camp, we were a little short of food. We were down to 2-meal-a-day ration. I think we used the same tea bag for about 3 days. Rav was out of tobacco. And I remember when we left to head back up to Old Chivac, we had one can of lima beans left in camp. And, you know, our last dinner was something like tuna on pancakes. Anyway, we made it back to Old Chivac. It was great. Pilot bread and peanut butter and jelly, and it never tasted so good. So I helped Rav up until into June, or well into June, actually. When hatching started, my study was going to be about how the goslings, what foods they ate, how their parents took care of them, etc., until the fledging. And so I started collecting goslings for my study and moved down to Mickelson's cabin in late June, where I stayed until mid-July that summer. And my daily routines in the cabin were most days get up in the morning, observe broods for 8 to 10 hours. Every once or twice a week, I went out and sampled vegetation and worked with the captive goslings. The next two summers, my wife, Connie, accompanied me. She was a nurse and was able to quit her job and get another job when we returned in the fall to support us while I was in graduate school. So we had two really idyllic summers in the Mickelson cabin, working together. Not much. We made all of our own bread. No bread was provided by the refuge, but we had plenty of flour and the ingredients for making bread. So we made bread every couple of weeks. And it was the same routine. A couple times a week, we'd be out of the cabin, either measuring plants or working with the goslings while they fed on native plants. And the rest of the time, we were just in the cabin going back and forth to an observation tower and making records of behavior of cackling goose broods. Okay, we're back. And I thought I'd just talk a little about what happened after my dissertation work, and then really talk about how much of this work has been used to inform managers of waterfowl. In the beginning, when work first started on the Yukon Kuskokwim Delta, dating back to the 1940s and 50s, our understanding of waterfowl populations was still pretty primitive. We didn't really know too much. We didn't know, you know, what factors govern nest success, for example. And really a lot of the early banding was just trying to understand how particular breeding areas might be linked to specific stopover or wintering areas for ducks and geese. And certainly that was the point of some of the early banding of Brant here in the lower Koshunik River. Dennis Raveling's work around Old Chivac was really related to some basic science questions about what factors regulated production of eggs by female geese. And my work was also kind of a basic science question of how did nutrition influence gosling growth rates and so on. Now that it turns out it's become a much more important question, which we'll get to in a few minutes. I finished my dissertation work at the University of California, Davis in December 1983, and their really jobs were pretty scarce. And I was, we had a new son a month before, and I was pretty nervous about getting a job when a series of positions opened up to work for what was the Fish and Wildlife Service at the time, their research branch, which is now part of the U.S. Geological Survey. And the impetus for that work was severe declines of multiple species of geese that nested on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. So cackling geese and white-fronted geese have both declined close to 90%. Brant had declined some. And emperor geese were also at low levels. So a significant amount of money for those days, about $800,000, was appropriated for the base budget of Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge, and they started work in 1983. And then those funds were moved to what's now the Alaska Science Center, to continue the work on geese in Western Alaska. And so a number of camps were put out. I had specifically asked to be at a Brant colony because I wanted to work with a colonial species. I had some basic science ideas I wanted to pursue. Just a brief aside, I think RAV study site, which was core high quality cackling goose nesting area, the declines that were being observed in the wintering flocks didn't really show up on RAV's study area until the early 1980s, and probably because the densities were maintained there because it was a preferred habitat. So I began work in 1984 at Tutakok River. That first year, foxes destroyed 98% of the nests we were monitoring, Arctic foxes. The next year, in 1985, we removed some foxes, six. Nest success increased from 2% to 6%. And the next year, we removed 26 foxes from the colony area, and nest success went up to 80%. We removed foxes for a few more years. At that point, nest success became pretty high, typically around 80%, and stayed there for a number of years. In the meantime, I had moved to the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, my first graduate student, Paul Flint, started at Tutakok River in 1987. And at the time, really, we were just trying to learn more about how Brant worked, you know, how what was nest success like, what factors were regulating the production of young, how well were goslings surviving. And Paul's project actually had a lot to do with that. The main impetus was trying to understand the survival rates of Brant goslings, which he did really well. And next we moved on to work by Mark Lindberg, was the second student on this project. Mark started in 1990 and was out here through at least 1993, so four field seasons. And Mark's interest was in primarily what was the interconnectedness between different Brant breeding associations. So there were four really well-known large colonies on the Yukon Delta at the time. One at Kokchuk Bay, which I mentioned earlier, the one here at Tutakok. There's one at Kigigak Island, and another on Baird Island in the adjoining Baird Peninsula. So we started marking birds intensively in 1986 and continued through Paul Flint's work. So we had a pretty good sample of marked birds that had been marked here, and then some marking had been done in the Arctic. And during Mark's project, we traveled to the other colonies on the Yukon Delta. Mark and I both to Kokchuk Bay and to Kigigak Island to read bands to try to determine how much movement was occurring from Tutakok River to these other areas. Mark also, when hatching was finished here at Tutakok, visited a couple of breeding sites in the Arctic at the Colville River Delta and then the Anderson River Delta, which had been a famous Brant study site and work done by Tom Berry of the Canadian Wildlife Service. And what Mark showed was that there was very little interchange of adults between these different breeding locations. And most of that was by males, which we believe were changing locations after a mate had died and they had acquired a new mate from a different breeding colony. They followed their mate to her colony. And that's just a bit of an aside. In geese, the females are very site faithful to the area where they were born, and the males tend to follow their mates back to the place where they nested. So we're now in year 36 of this study. As I said, I'm stepping aside. Mark has been managing, Mark Lindberg, the project for the last 2 years. And we've learned a lot that's a lot of importance actually to Brant management. We've shown over the years that the amount of food available for goslings directly drives their growth rates, and how well they grow before they gain flight strictly determines how well they're likely to survive their first year. So for example, goslings that are 900 grams, which would be 2/3 of a pound, roughly when they're 4 weeks old, are going to survive almost as well as an adult Brant. Whereas the goslings that's 600 grams, about 2/3 that size, currently has maybe a 10% chance of surviving its first year. So the amount of food available has a huge effect on how many new Brant we get in the population each year. And how much food is available comes back to that predation I talked about a little while ago. When we have really significant predation events like the ones my first 2 years here at Tutakok, the birds by the normal hatch period have all left. Brant typically fly to the Arctic to molt their flight feathers. And so in those years, there's little or no grazing that occurs on the vegetation that Brant need to for goslings to grow. The result of that is that a lot of this, what we call grazing lawns, it's a very short form of vegetation, grows up into a taller form that goslings can't eat. And the consequence of that is when we do get a good nest success year, now there's less food available for those goslings and they don't grow very well. So even though we've had good nest success, we don't produce very many new recruits into the population. We've been in this kind of a cycle now for since around 2000, where the predation years have been frequent enough that we've reduced or lost a lot of the grazing lawn that was here in the 1990s. So the good nest success years, goslings aren't growing well, they're not being recruited into the population. And the result has been that we've had very low recruitment rates for Brant really since the mid-1990s. That's reflected in the age ratio data. Recent publication by David Ward a couple of years ago showed long-term decline in the age ratios of Brant at Eisenbeck Lagoon in the fall. We've recently published a paper on annual survival rates showing declining survival rate of young from the YK Delta. In 2000, a gosling from the Yukon Delta had about a 45% chance of surviving on average its first year. Currently, those survival rates are less than 20%. Those have important implications for how well the population functions, and we believe is causing severe declines of Brant nesting on the coast of the YK Delta. Okay, let's continue our conversation about Brant research at Tutakok River on the Bering Sea coast. Talking to you from a weather port that's been here since April. There are a crew of four technicians here, plus Mark Lindberg, Dave Coons, who are other faculty persons. Mark is at University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's running the research program now, and Dave Coons is at Colorado State University and getting involved in the research, and will be taking the lead on this work in the future. In addition, Dave Steimek, who is a professional photographer, is here photographing the shorebirds and waterfowl that are here on the study area. As I mentioned a bit ago, I started work here in 1984, so this is year 36 of this study. And each year we come out, we monitor Brant nests in a colony that's in an area about 2 square miles. And we monitor several hundred to a bit over 1,000 nests each year. And in July, when the birds are flightless, they've dropped their wing feathers, and the goslings are about two-thirds grown, we capture the birds in banding drives where we herd the birds towards water bodies, typically one of the major rivers around. When we get them out onto a place where we can surround them, we surround them, and then we herd them into corral traps we set up. We put on plastic bands that some of you that have hunted Brant or observed Brant have seen. They're colored bands with three characters on them. And those are like a name tag for the birds. We use those to keep track of individuals, who they're paired with, and then how often they breed. We use those, the observations of those birds and the recoveries by hunters, to estimate survival rates And additionally, a student, Alan Leach, who finished a couple of years ago, has used those to keep track of how often birds lose a mate, how often they change mates. And Alan has shown, interestingly, that birds that lose a mate are much more likely to stick with their second mate less long, so they're more likely to change mates again, and they have poor success in rearing the next set of offspring. So losing a mate in these birds, and for the females actually, much lower survival if they have lost their mate. So being paired, which brant are paired for long periods of time, typically for life, is really important to their success. During hatch, which is about to start today or tomorrow, we go out onto the colony to the marked bird nests. We try to visit those nests when the goslings are either mostly hatched or in the nest, or the eggs are pipped where there's a large hole in the egg where we can get access to a gosling's foot. We put on a uniquely numbered tag through the web of the gosling, and then we capture those goslings later on during the banding drives I mentioned earlier. We know exactly how old that gosling is in days, so that when we weigh that gosling, we know how rapidly it's grown. And what we found over the years is that goslings today in 2019 are growing much more slowly than they did in the early 1990s. And that's related to the fact that there's less food available for them. I mentioned earlier on that the amount of food available for goslings declines following years of high predation. And we've had enough predation events over the last 20 years or so that there's substantially less food here for goslings once they've hatched than there was, say, in the early 90s. That's important to managers, because those goslings that are growing more slowly, which we've shown, are going to be less likely to survive their first year. And even if they do survive, they're going to be less likely to become a breeding adult. So growth conditions for these goslings out here are very important in terms of the maintenance and health of the overall brant population. Less detailed work has gone on in the Arctic, on the Arctic coastal plain of Alaska, or the North Slope, as some people refer to it. But there has been some web tagging for the last few years up there. Birds have been marked up there by a combination of scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey and Alaska Biological Research, who's had studies on the North Slope dating back to the 1990s. And Alan Leach, who I mentioned a minute ago, also analyzed or estimated survival rates of birds from both areas. And what we've seen is adult survival rates have dropped from about 89% to around 82% since 2000. But more strikingly, survival rates of goslings have declined substantially for goslings, both coming from the North Slope and from the YK Delta, where I'm speaking to you from. North Slope goslings' survival rates have declined from about 70% in 2000 to around 40% recently. Survival rate of goslings from the YK Delta has declined from about 45% in 2000 to under 20% recently. The fact that the birds from the Arctic are surviving better, is because they have much more food to eat while they're growing than the birds on the YK Delta, and that's contributing to higher survival rates. But the fact that goslings from both populations are surviving less well today than they were 20 years ago is cause for concern, and it suggests that there have been changes in habitat conditions for these birds on their migration or wintering areas that is reducing their probability of survival through their first winter and spring. We don't know what's causing that, but we're suspicious that it is changes in food availability for the birds after they leave the breeding grounds. So the work out here has had a mix of basic science questions that we've addressed. We've ask questions about, as I mentioned, you know, what's the effect of, or why do these birds stay mated for life? And we've gotten some answers to that. Their advantages to them and their own survival, their ability to raise young. We've asked questions about why they lay as many eggs as they do. And we're still working on the answer to that question. They don't lay as many as they can rear, so there's some limitations on how many eggs they lay. Some of those limitations are due to the fact they can't incubate more than about 5 eggs successfully. Other limitations are that goslings that come out of eggs laid later in the laying sequence, so if you're in the egg that was laid fifth, you've got much lower survival probability and you're going to grow more slowly than your brothers and sisters who came out of earlier eggs in that sequence. Additionally, while a lot of our work on like growth rates and those sorts of things have come from a basic ecological questions about how does this system function, what's the whole interaction among foxes, geese, and the food plants for geese, they've obviously had or clearly had very important implications for managers. They've allowed us to understand the effect of growth rate, which are being driven by habitat conditions, on survival and recruitment into the breeding population, which is important for understanding the potential dynamics of brant. And part of that is, you know, how much harvest can this population tolerate? Work that we've done in conjunction with David Ward at USGS, who observed birds in Mexico, allowed us to look at how, where the birds wintered influenced their breeding the next summer. And what we found was that the birds that wintered further north in Mexico at San Quintín were much more likely to breed following wintering at San Quintín than birds that wintered further south, say at San Ignacio in Mexico. And birds that were successful breeders in 1 year were much more likely to return to a more northern wintering location as well. So the birds set themselves up to be successful repeatedly. If they breed successfully, they tend to winter with their family in a more northern location, which then facilitates breeding more successfully the next year. That understanding also, of course, has important implications for management, because it's telling us that these more northern wintering areas, at least in Mexico, are more important for supporting breeding birds in the population than some of the more southern areas. There's been a tremendous shift of brant into Alaska for wintering. We haven't been able to get out there and determine who it is that's spending the winter at Eisenbeck Lagoon. So we don't really have a good understanding yet of how that shift in wintering distribution is influencing the dynamics of the overall brant population. I think I'll wind this up by just saying that we're continuing to do work. As I said, I think the future of the project is in great hands with Mark Lindberg and Dave Koons. I'm looking forward to continuing to visit the site and to publish research on this site, but I'm also really looking forward to seeing how this develops as it moves forward in time. I think this site has played a very important role in understanding how the brant population works. It's one of the best understood populations of waterfowl on the planet, but we still have a number of questions that we haven't fully addressed yet. For example, I earlier mentioned the linkage between fox predation and food availability for goslings. So one idea would be, well, if we could guarantee high nest success every year for a long time for brant, would that then restore the grazing lawns, that would increase gosling growth rates and first-year survival of goslings? And we don't really know the answer to that question. I'm fairly confident that if we don't ensure high nest success, that the brant population will continue to decline. But we can't guarantee that removing predation for a number of years is going to be successful, just because there's some pieces of that whole interaction we don't fully understand yet. And I'm hoping that Mark and Dave are going to be able to explore that in more detail moving forward. Additionally, there are a number of basic science questions. We know we have a lot of birds in this population that are high, highly fit. They have good social status. They can perpetuate their high social status and their success through their lifetimes. But then we continue to have birds in the population that seem to be of lower quality. And what generates those, continues to generate those low quality birds? Another question we haven't addressed. Additionally, this population has the potential to allow us to understand how relatives interact with each other. And that's a question, set of questions that Dave may take on, because we can do the genetics on birds that are, that we can follow them for long periods of time. And we had, a few years ago, our oldest remaining female died. She was 29 years old, a bird that we banded initially in 1986. So we can develop long histories of these birds, and we get to know them, and we can use that to help us to understand how Brant work, how they interact with each other, and the potentials for them to be successful going forward. So I hope you'd enjoyed this conversation, and that it's been informative for you, and I certainly enjoyed sharing my experiences in Western Alaska with you.
You've been listening to the Hunting Science Podcast. To find show notes on this episode and to leave comments and continue the conversation, visit our website at community.uif.edu/huntingscience.